And if you look at the suggestions that I am making, I think that they don't all fit into your characterization. For example, having an examiner available to testify about their conclusions, I would say is not taking away the clinical nature of the examination.
No, it's the second part of your
sentence. Number one, that says there should be two examiners doesn't take away from the clinical nature of the examination. Saying that counsel should have access to the information that the examiner has access to isn't taking away from the clinical nature of the examination. I'd argue that the one that at least you're focusing on is number two, which has to do with whether the examination occurs in court or outside of court. And I think that there are conflicting features here, and I will readily admit those. The points that are made by clinicians is that it's difficult to undertake examinations in open court. I can't address that not being a clinician. What I can address is my experience in hearings, which is that the people who conduct the examinations vary widely. They vary widely in the way that they examine people, and they vary widely in their inclinations on how to decide. And they, in my experience in sitting through 600 examinations, is that sometimes they go upon false assumptions, and sometimes they don't have complete information. Therefore, I feel that it's essential for there be someone there who can provide some uniformity, or at least a touchstone for uniformity. If an attorney, now this is a legal point, but I think it's a significant one. Under the system as it's proposed, an attorney can go up to the hospital or wherever the examination is going to be conducted and be present. But an attorney can't go back to the court hearing and testify about anything that happened there. It's just the nature of the judicial process. And so the only way the attorney can address any problems is through some sort of examination of the examiner, and there can be no contradictory evidence coming before that body upon dealing with the suppositions and the process of the examination that the examiner undertook. So what it does is that it makes the whole process more clinical in nature, takes away the uniformity and any checks upon the individual prejudices or interests of that examiner, as well as allows for what I would call peer interaction at the treating facility regarding the need for a particular patient to be committed or not committed. That means talking to the doctor about it, finding out what they have to say, talking to various nurses and so forth, rather than taking one of the proposals is just to allow the record, so a doctor has a complete record of the situation, something that is fairly objective and is controlled, so everybody knows what that examiner is looking at. That's a controlled situation in which there can be some input by a defense attorney.
Well, it would be your opinion then that as the bill was written, if they had the hearing outside of the court, the full court's type atmosphere, the attorney could be there. As the bill is written, the attorney could not present their client's views as to what happened in that hearing to the judge?
The client can testify as to what they felt happened, but the particular attorney can't testify as to what happened. And in fact, under the bill as it's proposed, the attorney doesn't have any guaranteed access to the doctors, to the treatment record, to staff, to all of the various parties that are made available to the examiner before they render an opinion.
Can I ask, Dr. Bray, would you agree with that as the bill is written?
In our discussions with the task force, I understood that if the attorney wished to accompany the person during the examination, they could. But what you're saying is that the attorney couldn't then use that information.
Before the judge.
Before the judge.
And this is. Well, I would ask you to research that for us, because I think that's a key point of the bill. Thank you, Mr.
Very quick. I'll try to move quickly. And I would like to personally apologize if my response before is inappropriate.
I think we've got a pretty good flavor of those sections that Representative Bellamy spoke, or was the exchange was all about.
Thanks. If I could finish off the last few.
Sure.
A patient is to receive a warning that anything they say or do can be used against them during the pre-hearing portion of the of confinement. But there is no protection for their exercising that right. One of the things that my experience in conducting hearings is that the fact that a person will not participate in treatment pre-hearing is a very important factor in determining whether to commit or not, because it goes to the very issue of voluntariness. It's absolutely critical. This is an area where I think that there's going to be immediate conflict. And the only way that I've been able to think to address it is to allow a patient to assert that right without it being held against them, the patient, which is after advisal not to participate in treatment or to talk to a physician or a treater. I think it's unfortunate that a person's psychotherapist patient privilege has to be taken from them in this bill, but if it is, there should be some other protection for that person so that they're not caught in that catch-22 situation.
What is the some other?
What I was saying was that I think it's unfortunate that those rights have been taken away, but if the privilege is to be taken away, there has to be, I would argue that the proposal that I have in number 5 would be a way to at least address that. Okay. In number 6, the concern here is, this is a concern of many people who have been through the system, is that being hospitalized is used as a punishment rather than treatment. If this bill is passed with the provisions for outpatient commitment and for a variety of commitment alternatives, some being outside the hospital, the concern is that whomever has control will say, you do X or else you go to the hospital. I would suggest to this committee that hospitalization is only appropriate when it's an appropriate treatment for a person's disorder, and it's not appropriate as a threat or a punishment, and that this needs to be addressed. Finally, I would suggest that a study be done if the bill is passed as contemplated, that a study be done to see what the effect of outpatient commitment is an expanded criteria. I have seen some initial studies coming out of North Carolina where outpatient commitment and preventative commitment have been instituted that suggest that they really aren't very effective and don't change individual patients' willingness to undergo treatment. The initial findings have been that the people who generally go through outpatient treatment continue to go out through outpatient treatment. The people who don't go through outpatient treatment end up either decompensating or ending up back in the system again. And because of that, I would argue that since this bill seeks to address the deficiencies in the mental health system by a fairly strict pulling back of providing rights to mentally ill people, that a study would be appropriate to present to the next legislature to find out if taking away those rights really is effective in providing people with better treatment.
Mr. Taylor, you have a question?
Sure. Isn't it correct that in many regards this bill expands the rights of patients? As an example, the fact that it gives them the equivalent of a Miranda warning now? If I may, I'll direct your attention to Section 11 of the bill.
Well, You may notice in the bill that it requires a Miranda warning to be given, but there is no remedy if it isn't. So, and in fact, that is a meaningless right. Secondly,
present. You're saying to me that if a Miranda warning is not given, that a motion to suppress could not be filed?
Under this bill specifically, if I can find the section, specifically
section
indicates.
Section 11, number 4.
Yeah. Failure to give a warning under this section does not in itself constitute grounds for exclusion of evidence that would otherwise be admissible in a proceeding. Right now, the information we're talking about would be.
Isn't that the fruits of the poisonous tree, though? Your warning is not, in other words, that you could not admit this testimony, but you could still admit through other sources the evidence.
I read this act as a whole as saying that you no longer have psychotherapist or physician-patient privilege, and that every aspect of your treatment while you're on a pre-hearing detention is admissible, and while it's recommended that a warning be given, that failure to give that warning has no effect. That's how I read this.
So you're reading it in such a way that if a statement were made that even if the evidence taken from that statement could be supported by collateral sources, outside sources, that it could not be admissible.
Right now?
Yeah.
Oh, right now, right. It depends on the privilege that you're seeking to exercise. If a statement by a patient is made in the presence of a nurse, for example, it would clearly come under the nurse-patient privilege. If it was made in the presence of a physician and it had anything to do with treatment, it would be excludable. But if it was something completely outside of the treatment milieu, arguably it could be admissible.
And under this proposal, would it not allow the introduction of evidence such as was given in a statement if supported by collateral source?
I don't think there's any necessity for support for the collateral sources in the bill as it's proposed.
Okay, if they could support it independently of the statement.
Well, I'm losing your point now.
Okay, failure to give a warning under the section does not in of itself constitute grounds for the exclusion of evidence that would otherwise be admissible in the proceedings.
Right.
So if evidence was obtained through the statement could be excluded, but you could still introduce the evidence if supported by evidence by independent means.
Again, I don't read it that way.
Okay, thanks.
I read it as allowing. Well, you have to understand also that a treatment record contains, in many ways, is a horror list. It's what a person says, what a person does, what treatment they received during the time of their hospitalization. So that treatment record will contain all of these. Anything that is an indicia of mental illness or dangerousness will be in the treatment record.
So the way you read this statement is that despite the fact that we have to give him a Miranda warning, if we get evidence from him, we can still use it evidence.
That's as I read this bill as it presently exists.
I disagree with you on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good to know, because if I ever have to raise it, I'll hope that you're the judge.
I don't agree with that. Directing your attention to page 5, line 10, I'm going to ask you the same questions that I've asked the two other prior attorneys. Looking at subsection C, large C, mm-hmm. Looking at that definition there, is this definition, in your viewpoint as an attorney, constitutional? And if not so, what provision of the Oregon and U.S. Constitution does it violate?
Well, I think the immediate answer is it's certainly subject to attack under Donaldson. Donaldson sets forth the dangerous to self, dangerous to other criteria, and the standard of clear and convincing evidence for a finding of mental illness. Query whether one can find by clear and convincing evidence dangerousness under the language of C. It's a long hop. There may also be problem, and this is due process. These are due process issues.
Under federal or
under
state?
This is federal law. Now, under state law, of course, the present Commitment Act has been found to be constitutional on a number of occasions, the present criteria. In terms of C, I think I wouldn't give you a conclusive opinion on it. I would say that it would be more open to attack. One of the things that makes me think this, and it's not directly on point, it's somewhat collateral, but I've used it in commitment hearings, is the very broad and expansive reading that the court has given to the right of free speech in Oregon. When I was an attorney at the public defenders, I was able to overturn a city ordinance that had to do with begging on the basis that it violated the free speech provisions of the Oregon Constitution. A lot of the behavior that is addressed in the expanded criteria has to do with oral type behavior by patients, one of the ways that they express themselves. I think that's one of the areas of attack that I would anticipate.
And did you, that was here, in the Portland area?
Yeah.
And did that go to the appellate courts?
No, there was an initial appeal and it was withdrawn because it was a dead loser for the state. And the most recent opinion of the Supreme Court on obscenity under that the same Oregon constitutional provision, I think, underlines the fact that this is a very broad, there's a very broad reading of that provision in the state.
Did you rely on the Oregon Constitution at all in that case?
Solely. It was, as I said, it was a dead winner. The federal argument was a lot weaker.
And what provisions in Oregon did you rely on rather than the federal?
What is it? Is it Section 11? I don't remember the exact. It's the free speech.
Will you supply us with that? Yeah. The free speech. Go ahead. Finish your sentence. I didn't mean to interrupt.
It's the free speech amendment in the Oregon Constitution, in the Bill of Rights. I think it's Section 11.
Okay. Thank you. That's all the witnesses that we have signed up. Are there further persons here that wish to testify? I think we should get copies of this Donaldson case for committee members.
Sure. I would like to say that I know a number of people that would like a chance
we will certainly accept written commentary so long as this bill is within our possession. So you might want to get that information back to those people, David. And so long as the bill is in our possession. And any further committee business?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bellamy.
The bill has been out long before Thursday. Our first hearing was on last Tuesday, and the bill has been printed, so it's not a fair statement to say that it just came out as of Thursday.
I didn't say that. I said they got it on Thursday.
Yeah.
And it's moving pretty quick. Yeah.
Some people would
say we don't move quick enough.
The bill is still in this committee's possession. I will accept written testimony for the committee and make sure it circulates. And the committee members populate this building regularly. They have phones and addresses. So with that, any further comments from the committee? I will close the public hearing, and we're adjourned.